What'll it be?
I was going to fill up with whatever's cheapest.
I'll be happy to take care of that for you.
I thought this was self-serve.
We're completely full service here at Empire State Gas. Sure, it may cost you a bit more, but you're worth it. Now, what else can I get you? Something from the snack shop for you and the little lady?
There is no little lady. I'm alone. And I just ate.
Well, how about a complimentary balloon animal for the kids?
I have no kids, and I'm still alone.
Well, don't feel bad. You may be alone, but you're wise enough to come to the largest independently owned gas station chain in the Northeast United States.
We're in Los Angeles.
I'm sure that you know that our gas is organically grown and good for the environment.
Good for the environment?
That's right. When you burn our fuel, you're actually helping to reverse climate change. That's why we say at Empire State Gas, from farm to pump, we've got great gas.
And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Celebrity deaths.
Dean Haglund, last week we remembered a couple of rather famous film directors.
Yes, we did.
You had to replay the entire show in your mental Rolodex there.
Exactly. There's been so many that I'm going, oh, yeah, there was, we did, famous directors. That's right.
If we're 10 seconds over at the end of the show, I can always cut that pause out. You know, no sooner had we completed last week's show, or at least no sooner had last week's show dropped and become available to our legion of loyal listeners.
Yes.
Than a true giant of the film industry, a true giant of cinema, up there, I would say, with the Kurosawas, with the Fellinis, the Ozus, the Scorseses, died. And it was interesting because I realized that had he died just a few hours earlier, we probably would never even have mentioned Cimino or the director of The Wicker Man, Robin Hardy, because we would have been so busy talking about Abbas Kiarostami, the Iranian film master.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and a lot of people around the world maybe don't get to see Iranian cinema. As we know, if a film plays well in America, then it tends to get a wide release internationally.
Right.
And of course, there's certain territories that will do cultural trade and whatnot. But I fear that all too many people in the world don't get a chance to watch Iranian films. And so they're
I think that's true.
So they're surprised when I say that if you are watching a film, let's say, from the late 80s onward, that is a beautiful, thoughtful, poetic expression of humanism, you're probably watching a film from Iran.
Right.
And their new wave, what's considered their new wave, began in probably the late 70s And then by the early 90s, like I said, so many filmmakers had really found a level of achievement I mean, there's more than a handful of masters that have come from Iran in the last 25, 30 years. Filmmakers like Jafar Panahi and Asghar Fahadi. But no one was greater than Abbas Kiarostami. He was born in Tehran. His first artistic experience, much like my friend in podcasting, Dean Haglund, was painting, was fine art, which he continued into his late teens, winning a painting competition at the age of 18, shortly before he left home to study at the University of Tehran School of Fine Arts.
Wow.
He majored in painting and graphic design and supported his studies by working as a traffic policeman.
That's what does.
As a painter, designer, and illustrator. Yeah, you know, I wash dishes to make my way through school. His part-time gig was a little bit cooler than mine,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, true.
Although I ate for free.
Well, I'm sure he got out of a lot of traffic tickets. I'm just saying. Think of the savings.
And he passed those savings on to us.
Yes, he did.
As a painter, designer, and illustrator, Kiarostami worked in advertising in the late 1960s, designing posters and creating commercials. He was active as a film director, screenwriter, photographer, and film producer starting around 1970. And as such, was involved in more than 40 films, including shorts and documentaries. He attained critical acclaim for directing the Coker trilogy, which lasted from 87 to 94. And in 1990, did a movie called Close Up, which is on the list, well, any list that you look up, of probably the 50 greatest films of all time. And it right. is rather extraordinary. It tells a true story about a man who impersonated a famous Iranian film director, which tells you a lot about Iran's culture and their love of movies, that in the 1980s, someone would want to impersonate a famous film director, where here in the States, there was pretty much Spielberg and there were no other famous film directors.
Right. And you wouldn't know what they look like anyway.
How exactly.
Would you impersonate them?
Although I think not knowing what a director looks like helps to impersonate one of them.
That's true.
Yes. But so this film is about a real life case and a real life court case. And then the long term incarceration of the person who perpetrated this fraud, pretending to be this movie director. It is a fictional account of this true story, using all the real people playing themselves.
Wow.
So it really begs this question of, what do we mean when we say something is factual? What do we mean when we say it's real? And what do we mean when we say it's authentic?
Right.
You know, really interesting themes to explore, and themes that you and I have been drawn to for many years.
Yeah. So I impersonate, I take the people that were all affected by the impersonation, bring them in, and then have them reenact exactly what happened.
No, not exactly. I don't think exactly what happened, because it's not a docudrama. It's a narrative fiction film. So Kiarostami read the accounts of the trial, but he wove a narrative around it using the real people.
Wow.
Because again, in very Rashomon style, right? How do you do the quote unquote factual account when no two people's account will be the same?
That's right. Where does that truth lie? Somewhere in the middle or not at all?
And many of these themes were things that he would explore. His movie, Taste of Cherry, actually won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival in 1997. And so, I mean, think about this guy's career. In 1997, he wins the Palme d'Or. I think 10 years later or 9 years later, he's the jury chairperson for the Cannes Film Festival. I mean, that's what an acclaimed, important international filmmaker he was, the president of the jury. In fact, it was 8 years later, 2005. In 2010, he made a movie that I talked about, was one of my top 10 for the year, and you seemed fascinated by it. It was a movie called Certified Copy, and it explored a relationship between a author and a fan who shows up to a book signing and wants to get a bunch of his books signed for her son, and she ends up driving him around the countryside in Italy. The woman is Juliette Binoche. The man, whose name actually escapes me because he wasn't an actor. He was a first-time actor, but a very legendary opera singer. And the woman drives him around, and they talk, and they get to know each other. And then when they stop at a coffee shop and he goes out to make a phone call, she gets into a conversation with the woman who runs the coffee shop, who mistakes the man for her husband. When he comes back, they continue to play along with that charade. And then a strange thing happens. For the rest of the movie, they are married. They talk about their son. They talk about the need to get back together again. So you don't know whether the first half was real or the second half was real. And ultimately, it doesn't matter because both halves were so authentic. The characters were real and believable. And one of the ongoing conversations, which is one of the reasons you were fascinated by it, was this idea that they explore, because they go to all these museums and he shows her all these supposedly classic works of art, all of which turn out to be forgeries. And she says, oh, so they're not the works of art. And he says, of course they're works of art. They're every bit the works of art of the original. They're just not the work of art you think you're looking at.
How intriguing. And I'm looking this up right now. It's William Scheimel.
Who's the opera singer. Absolutely.
Opera baritone opera singer, yes.
Mm. So it's a terrific movie, and it was the first movie Kiarostami made outside of his native Iran. He made it in Italy, and again, it was an international cast. You know, many filmmakers will win prizes for their movies, of course. There's no shortage of awards, and many of them, of course, like the Palme d'Or, are very prestigious.
Big deals.
Right?
Yeah.
But I wanted to run down, if I could, just some of the non-movie-specific awards this man was honored with during his life. He was given an honorary doctorate at the École Normale Supérieure in 2003. He was given the Academy of Arts in Berlin's Konrad Wolf Prize in 2003. As I mentioned, he was the president of the jury at the Cannes Festival in 2005. He was granted a fellowship of the British Film Institute in 2005.
Wow.
He was given an honorary doctorate at the University of Toulouse in 2007. Now realize this is before he's ever made a movie outside of Iran. This is just for what his contribution had been up until that point. He was acclaimed as one of the world's great masters at the Kolkata International Film Festival in 2007. At the Venice Film Festival in 2008, he was granted Glory to the Filmmaker Award. I mean, I feel like these festivals, all of which are real, all of which are august and prestigious, were needing to invent new terminology just to describe what this guy's contribution was.
Wow.
I'm almost done here. In 2010, the year of Certified Copy, he was given an honorary doctorate at the University of Paris. He was given Japan's Medal of Honor in 2013. And finally, in 2014, the Austrian Decoration for Science and Art. That is quite a legacy to leave behind. If you love cinema, I urge you to immerse yourself in the world of Iranian cinema, especially from 1990, late 80s onward, and certainly the works of Abbas Kiarostami. They're poetic, and they deal in very rich themes while never losing sight of the fact that story comes through character.
Absolutely. We learned that again and again.
Dean, I'm absolutely out of insights to share, but I think we'd be remiss if we did not at least allude to the fact that we went right from another terrorist attack in this country into violent interactions between police and citizenry.
Yeah.
This last
all of a sudden.
Week.
I know. And, you know, just as hate becomes hate, it seems to re-echo like a ripple through a pond. And it takes so much comedy to battle against that, doesn't it?
Yeah, hate becomes hate. Anger begets anger.
Right.
Know? And so there's a debate. Right over should it be hashtag Black Lives Matter or should it be hashtag All Lives Matter? I've weighed in on this before, but I would point out there was a very interesting article about how you know, many people with very good intentions say that it should be All Lives Matter, and those people are probably not aware how that slogan is being used by some very racist personages and groups. So they may want to just consider that. But also, I kind of feel like when you're arguing over slogans, you're not heading in the right direction anyway.
Well, exactly, because then it becomes a binary issue again. You either are for cats or against dogs, but you can't be a dog and a cat person. Like, so by having it one or the other, you're creating a larger divide when at the time we're looking for unity. The hashtagging argument seems to just exacerbate the anti-unity story.
Well, yeah, and you really hit the nail on the head with, you know, living in this binary way, which is the conversation surrounding the police, right?
Right. Police. If you're pro-police, you're anti-black. If you're pro-black, you're anti-police.
Right. As opposed to knowing that there probably is no harder job in this
right.
world, maybe other than perhaps school teacher, honestly, but certainly, you know, a job where you literally are putting your life on the line on behalf of your fellow human being on a daily basis, mm-hmm. and you're often out there alone, right? So, of course, we, you know, love the idea of people who serve us in that way, and we know that it's a really hard job. And
right.
the point that I always come back to is you know, really the wonderful lines that Orson Welles wrote in his movie Touch of Evil. It's supposed to be a hard job. That's the point. Being
yeah.
police is only ever going to be easy in a police state.
Right. Exactly. So you're not going to have the ability. You're always going to be faced with difficult decisions.
Yeah, exactly. And so the idea that you're faced with difficult decisions and the fact that it's so hard is ever an excuse for inappropriate behavior by a police officer doesn't hold water, because it's supposed to be hard. It's supposed to be hard. And when it ever starts to become easy, we really had better look out, because it means that the laws are protecting the police and not the rights of the citizenry.
Yeah. And then also, you know, this, I mean, I'm always shocked that it's like not one shot fired, but always 4 shots, 10 shots. It's like, it seems to be such an emotional knee-jerk reaction from somebody with the firearms that, you know, all of that emotion has to be tempered with intellect. You can't just let your id run wild, no matter what side you're on.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Well, and so, although, you know, this gets into a very interesting psychological conversation, but, you know, is it the emotions or is what's being revealed, you know, a psychological patterning of thought that
right.
is allowed to develop? And you
so
know,
you're saying it's the culture itself within the police force.
Well, I just I just think, you know, you develop ways of thinking, and either you are fighting against it or you're giving into it. But either way, you know, you're not really coming to terms with how you're thinking about your fellow human beings, and
right.
therefore it comes up at altogether the worst possible time. You know, we know for a fact, right, that when a police officer ever unholsters their gun and uses it, I think they then have to go to counseling, right? There's mandatory
yeah.
counseling in the wake of that. I don't know. There probably are police forces that do this, but honestly, it is such a hard job. Shouldn't there be mandatory counseling for these people all the time, like on a weekly basis?
Yeah, so that
shouldn't,
every time...
You know, we should be offering for their own benefit, for the benefit of their families, you know, all that stuff that they keep compartmentalized, that they try to leave at the office and you know, don't affect their families with. And yet we know that when you do compartmentalize, when you do try to keep things secret, that's destructive in and of itself. So giving mm-hmm. these people not only access to someone to talk to on a weekly basis, but making it mandatory on a
yeah.
weekly basis could really benefit the police themselves, if nothing.
Well, and this is, you know, when I was doing Amateur Night in Vancouver, the off-duty police officers were up the street, and they would come to the comedy club all the time. And one of them said, just to remind us that, you know, every day all we see is the worst of the city of Vancouver. We just see the worst people every day, all day. And without coming to a comedy club or going out and seeing other people do stuff, you assume that the entire city is just the worst of people of all the time. So it's important, and I don't know if this is unique to Vancouver, but I don't know if how much that's encouraged
well,
anywhere else.
You know, this is a breathtaking segue you just created into what we're reading, because I started reading a book that reminded me of the fact that as divisive as this country seems to be, as torn apart by all manner of issues as the USA seems to be, if you look at the news or mm-hmm. you pay attention to Washington, D.C., when you go out into the world, it really doesn't feel that way too often in too many places.
Right.
I'm reading a book, and of course what we're reading is brought to you by Booksmith Used Books in Nelson, British Columbia, fine purveyor of used books and all things literary. I'm reading Dispatches from Pluto by Richard Grant.
Oh.
And this is a book about the Mississippi Delta, an area that I have fallen in love with, and
yes.
where I plan to eventually at least split my time between Los Angeles and there.
And start up that blues band you always wanted.
No, a Main Street movie theater, as you know. And,
that's right, of course.
Mentor filmmakers, because there's a big film movement there, as there is. You know, I was getting into a conversation with someone who was talking about how Los Angeles is really not a great city for creative inspiration. It's a great city for honing your skills as an artist,
right.
as a storyteller, and practicing them. But for the inspiration, so many people have to go elsewhere to get that inspiration. When I was writing The Lady Killers, I had to get the hell out of LA, right?
Right.
But then it was a great place to come and make the film. And there's no place more creatively, artistically inspiring than the Mississippi Delta. I mean, this is, after all, where the blues was created, where country music started, where rock and roll was born, right? All
right.
the American music forms, there's so much fine art there. I went into these local galleries, Dean, and you would be blown away at the quality of the work there. So anyway, I've been reading this book. It was a British journalist relocated to the Mississippi Delta, and he wrote this book while living there called Dispatches from Pluto. And I wanted to share one little passage with you.
Okay.
When he was moving there, According to him, the Republican-dominated legislature, caricatured by Saturday Night Live as 30 hissing possums in a barn, was trying to close down the state's last abortion clinic, and a 52-year-old Delta man had just been arrested in a police sting operation while having carnal relations with a show hog.
Okay, I think you said show hog.
I did.
But yeah.
Do y'all
prize winning hog?
Do y'all even know what a show hog looks like when they get through with all the shampooing and blow drying and beauty treatments? Said my friend Martha Foos, the cookbook writer. She was calling from her house in the Delta town of Greenwood, less than a mile from the unnatural crime scene. It's a beauty pageant for swine. And they get those hogs dolled up, they shave their underparts and curl their eyelashes and buff their little trotters, and I guess it's just more than some guys can stand. I call it dating down the food chain. And frankly, it's a wonder it doesn't happen more often.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
That's an actual conversation.
That's an actual conversation that this journalist had when he was moving there with a famous cookbook writer who lives there. So I just can't wait to immerse myself in this book. That's what I'm reading. How about you, Dean? Are you still reading this corporate manifesto?
I am. I've gone on from Finding Your Purpose to It's Not What You Sell, It's What You Stand For. By Roy M. Spence Jr. I think I talked about that before. It's a compendium to the Finding the Purpose inspired movement in corporate America. And again, it's what is behind the every business a successful business. It's very actually uplifting for an independent entrepreneur such as myself. To go, oh yeah, why are you doing this? Why do you bang your head against the wall? Why do you brush yourself off, get yourself back up, and start all over again? It's what you stand for.
You know, Stephen Fowler's the independent proprietor of the Booksmith used bookstore there in Nelson, British Columbia, and he's mm-hmm. offering a 20% discount on the next purchase for anyone who mentions Chill Pack Hollywood Hour when they get to the till. But
wow.
This is for actual listeners only, so let's not go posting this on social media. Okay? Booksmith Quality Used Books, 338 Baker Street, Nelson, British Columbia. Tell them Dean and Phil sent you.
Absolutely.
Hey, I have a live event of the week that is going to knock you on your ass.
Okay, can't wait. I'm putting the patty down.
The Chill Pack Hollywood Live Event of the Week.
That might have been a little bit distorted, that intro that I just played. Boy, that was loud. Every week I'm at the Los Angeles Breakfast Club, as you know, and
I know.
There is always a live presentation there. This week it was a presentation given by the librarian from the Magic Castle.
Oh,
they
fantastic.
Have a library with something like
yes.
tens of thousands of different articles in there and
yes.
books. And
I've been down there. Have you been down in the basement in the library?
No,
have you
I
seen
have
that?
Not. I saw it when I saw it. It was still up in the top floor. And I asked about it because I knew that there had been that fire in the top floor. But it turns out, as you know, and I did not, they had moved the library already down to the basement.
Yes.
Something like and 6 months earlier, before that
fire. Oh, is that right? They just missed it? Yeah. Fantastic.
So she came and she talked about the history of the Magic Castle itself, of that house, long before it was the Magic Castle. Of that Hollywood area. I mean, how much do you love this? So long before there's even the name Hollywood Land, right? Or Hollywood.
Right.
That house is standing there at a time when temperance is the law of the area. The prohibition was in effect long before anyone had come up with the word prohibition or enacted it as a law. It was totally dry, that area, by law. And there were land grants given to anyone who was going to open a house of worship of any kind.
Oh.
So temperance and houses of worship, exactly what you still think of when you think of Hollywood to this day.
It's true. No, it's not, actually.
And so she would intersperse her historic stories with demonstrations of magic. And by conducting a seance with yours truly.
No. In front of the entire Bexhill Breakfast Club?
In front of everyone. So I went up there, and I had to, on the back of a postcard, write my name and my favorite place. And so I wrote, Phil Lernes, Los Angeles Breakfast Club. And then I gave it to her for her to hold in her palm. And then she gave it back to me face down to place on this table and to put my hand atop it. And then she contacted the other side to see if they had a message for me.
Wow.
And seemingly they didn't until I turned that postcard over. And there was something written on the postcard for me.
What was it?
I think the words were...
You owe me rent?
Well, hold on. I'm getting the information right now. I'm conducting a seance again. Whatever you are, be a good one.
Where you are, be a good one.
Wherever you are, whatever you are, whatever you are, be a good
one. Whatever you are, whatever you are, be a good one.
And so... Well, that's... You know, I know how some of this was done, but I'm scratching my head about part of it.
See, that's the thing about the Magic Castle, is there's magicians all over the place, and they're doing magic all the time, and I always get pissed off. I have a love-hate relationship with all magic shows, because it's, while entertaining, makes me very angry that I can't figure it out, And that head scratching doesn't cheer me up. It frustrates the hell out of me. So you say this seance magic trick, how that's a head scratcher?
Yeah.
It this is my same experience every time I go to the Magic Castle.
Lily,
I don't know how.
Lily was up there, and I'm not going to get the materials quite right, but it doesn't matter. The point is that the woman put on her palm a gold coin and then a silver coin on top of the gold coin, and then pressed down on the silver coin until it pushed through not only the gold coin, but her palm itself, Lily's palm itself, and then fell to the floor.
Right. Yeah, I've seen that one too. That's a tricky one.
And she was standing there, and she said it hurt. She said she could feel it go through her hand.
Wow.
So anyway, so there's my live event of the week. How is comedy in Sydney, Australia teaching you treating you, and what's the latest with your club?
Ah, yes. Well, we seem to be moving forward. I need to have a few more meetings to make sure this can all happen, but
so that you can find out what it is your comedy club stands for.
Well, see, that's the thing. We're starting with that. Why even do a comedy club in Sydney? And the fact is...
Well, for the benefit of the Vancouver police officers who only see the worst in humanity.
Right. Why not the Sydney police officers as well? No, but there's also a massive quantity of highly, highly skilled and entertaining improvisers and stand-up comics. And seemingly, well, there's more stand-up venues, but there's very few improv venues, theaters... for which improvisers to ply their wares. So it seems that there is what they say, a hole in the market, a little niche to fill, and I think I'm just the guy to fill it.
Whatever you are, be a good one.
See that? That's exactly it. So, I'm not ready to splash that announcement all over the front pages, but slowly it's bubbling forth. Shall we say?
Have you seen any movies, Dean Haglund?
Oh, my God. Not in the big screen, just on my Netflix. Just been watching some of those originals and catching up on a few other ones that I had missed when it went through the theater, such as the super depressing Liam thing called The Gray. Did you see this one?
Oh, you mean Liam Neeson? Yeah, you know, this
Liam
made,
Neeson, yeah.
This made a lot of top 10 lists, a lot
yeah.
of them. And I really had a problem with a movie about slaughtering wolves.
Absolutely. It's a story of alpha male against alpha male, I take it. At the end, the weirdest ending to any being hunted and hunting wolves story. But yeah, that's basically it, is kill or be killed when a plane goes down in the Alaska outback. I don't think it's called the outback in Alaska. In the Alaska wilderness, and a pack of wolves that seem to kill for no reason other than to kill, which doesn't sound accurate, and the motley crew of survivors that try to survive, and spoiler alert, we don't know. We don't know if they survive or not.
I mean, it's effective, right?
Some of the camera work's amazing.
And people... did enjoy it, and you know, it has this story. It is about someone who has every reason, I guess, to give up on life, and mm-hmm. yet fights to survive. And so that would be a theme obviously explored in the Oscar winning The Revenant this last
yes.
year. Though, of course, that's motivated by revenge. Again, though, I guess so is Liam Neeson to a degree, motivated by revenge in this thing.
Yeah.
But it's why I found, you know, again, Gravity. One of the reasons I found Gravity so compelling and so refreshing, there's no bad guy. You don't have to vilify nature. I am very uncomfortable with any film that seems to justify, again, unconscious feelings or belief systems people have that really nature deserves all the shit we're putting it through.
Exactly. And apparently, I mean, I was intrigued by the credits where it said the movie is based on a novel called A Gray Ghost Walks Among Us, A Gray Ghost Walks Among Us, or something like that.
So you're going to refer to Liam Neeson as the Gray Ghost from now on?
Well, no, I assume the Gray Ghost may be the wolf,
it's the wolf.
As a
it's the
metaphor.
Wolf. Yeah, it's the yes. wolf. Yeah.
But at one point, there's a shot at the very end where he's staring into a gray sky saying, you know, show yourself now, whatever deity he's talking to. Show yourself right now. Show yourself. And he's just talking to gray sky. And maybe that's the Gray Ghost. Like, I'm sure the novel is rich in metaphor that perhaps gets lost in just a sort of straightforward telling yeah. of the movie.
A book as allegory, of course. Yes.
Yeah. And I don't know if that allegory came across. It became just a survival movie where we're hunting wolves and killing them all and eating their body over a fire. I mean, all of that. Kind of like, ugh.
See, I went to see this summer's Jaws, The Shallows.
Oh, yes.
And this is a big, pretty big hit, given its budget. And it's effective enough. I mean, the first 20 minutes are, you're rooting for anyone you meet to get eaten by a shark as fast as possible because of all the banal conversations and horrible characterizations.
Right.
But once they're out on the water, then the movie, oddly enough, finds its footing. You know, all the stuff that Spielberg said was hard, the shooting on the water, that's the stuff these filmmakers make look easy. The the stuff with characters and actors, that's tough. Anyway, but the point about this is that it is effective enough. It is quote unquote fun enough. There are some amazing attacks. I found myself at times, you know, really laughing in delight at the shark attacks and things. But but there's a neat little twist in how they introduce a video camera. That becomes an important plot device. And at one point, when the woman, the female lead, is stranded on these rocks that are basically an island out there, and the shark is circling around it for 24 hours, she's playing back this video footage on this helmet cam, and she sees that the shark has some kind of it doesn't look like a harpoon, but it almost looks like an arrow, but it might have just been a big industrial bolt or something that is sticking out of the side of its mouth. Like it's wounded and is, you know, feverishly angry. Right?
Right.
So I'm starting to dread, oh dear God, it's going to be Aesop. She's going to take the thing out.
Thorn out of the pot.
And then they'll be friends forever. So I'm dreading that. But it doesn't occur to me to dread what will really happen, which is she will take the information that the shark is badly injured and therefore that's why it's attacking, as evidence that, hey, I can shoot sharp objects into that shark.
What?
Yeah.
That's the takeaway from
that's
that?
That's the takeaway, yeah. So,
Its weakness is I can shove sharp objects.
Ultimately, like I said, this is not a movie without its charm and without its fun and you know, it's effective. But ultimately... not only is logic thrown out the window, because those of us who know sharks know that, you know, they don't attack what's beneath them, right? They attack
right.
what's above them. This shark
right.
apparently is so pissed off, it hasn't read that manuscript. So in the climactic
right.
scene, it's swimming down to get her at the bottom of the ocean. We have to kill this shark in the most brutal way possible. You know, and one could say, well, they did in Jaws, right? But
right.
the thing about Jaws was that, yes, there's this great white shark that is this threat. But the real threat is all the people. People
yeah.
are the real evil in that. Their short-sightedness, their
right.
greed, their refusal to respect...
Close the beach.
And to respect nature.
Yeah.
That is what is truly at cause for all the deaths and all the destruction. It's man is the enemy in that. And
right.
that I can get behind, right? And
yeah.
This movie, like The Gray, it's the bad guys or the animals.
Hmm.
You know, wolf lives matter. Shark lives matter.
See what you're doing? Exactly.
I think I'm alienating and offending. I'm alienating and offending people is what I'm doing.
Well, exactly. And this comes to movies in general. You know, story is dramatic conflict. Where do we find conflict? By villainizing something and overcoming it by killing it. You know, they did that... statistical analysis, some university went through and did 2,700 different books, plays, and movies and found there's only six plots that the computer analyzed it and found the six plots. And all of them are the same thing. You fall, you rise, you fall again, you rise, you fall. You know, the variations on those sort of overcoming obstacles and stuff like that. And that conflict is always dramatized as... defeating some obstacle, be it nature and killing it, you know. So I'm now just watching silent films, short comedies. That's all I'm going to watch.
Silence Under the Stars starts up again next week at Paramount Ranch. So I look forward
oh, yeah.
to telling you about that. But I, among other things... you know how we're talking about we'll do a top 10 show sometime of our top 10 favorite horror films
yes.
of all time, right? I think we could really go through and do different genres maybe every year, do a top 10, you know, like the AFI, you know, your
right.
top comedies, your top. And one year I would love to do musicals, but I was inspired to ask, does Dean Haglund like musicals? Because on the one hand, you don't like music, but on the other hand, you like dance.
Well, see, that's the thing. I do like, there's some musicals that were totally jaw-dropping seeing them as a kid. The Singing in the Rains, Broadway Follies of 1933, like all of the great Busby Berkeley camera work and all that sort of thing. So there are some musicals that really do stand out. That is to say, do I rush to New York every summer to see the latest in Broadway musicals? I don't. So there's some that irritate me and some that are totally spellbinding and thrilling. So,
well, I think when you're talking about a movie musical, it needs to be a movie first. You know, I don't care if it was a great Broadway show. I want it to be a great movie. And whatever you've got to do to make that a great movie, that's what matters to me. If I'm seeing a film.
Yeah, for sure. And there's some that don't translate at all. And, you know, even the early days of film, that's all they did was take Broadway shows and musicals and just put a camera in the audience. And, you know, that's why they were called photo plays in the early days.
I saw over the 4th of July weekend three classic musicals that I had never seen. Music Man from 1962, Yankee Doodle Dandy from 1942, and On the Town from 1949. And I saw them in that order. And the reason I saw them in that order, Dean Haglund, was because I knew that I wasn't going to like The Music Man. I knew that I probably would find Yankee Doodle Dandy to be past its expiration date, and yet I would understand its appeal to audiences of the time, and especially audiences thereafter who continued to be huge James Cagney fans. So
I know.
I think of that tap dancing. I expected that, and then I saved On the Town for last. This was the first film to be directed by Gene Kelly with Stanley Donen, and of course it starred Gene Kelly and Frank Sinatra, and of course Ann Miller. So what is not to love? So I saved the best for last. And what ends up happening is I fall in love with not only The Music Man, but with Robert Preston's performance in it, which is incredibly modern. I find it to be an adaptation of a Broadway show that very subtly uses cinematic devices to great effectiveness. Things like lighting cues and irises and thinking of the world as 360 degrees. This Broadway director had done the show. This was one of only three movies he would make. And he really thought through how he wanted to explore geographically the world of The Music Man. So every set is completely a working set, 360 degrees up and down. So it's it's an incredible cinematic achievement. And like I said, Robert Preston, unbelievably modern in his work as the lead. So it's a musical for me to grow old with. what a surprise. Yankee Doodle Dandy, exactly what I expected it to be. And I've been thinking a lot about how James Cagney, let's face it, not really a huge star anymore. And I know that sounds funny because he's dead, but Humphrey Bogart is still a huge star, right?
Still known, yeah.
You know, and Katharine Hepburn, still a huge star. Someone like Bette Davis, not as huge a star as she was. And James Cagney, I won't say forgotten, but he's not... He's not Spencer Tracy. He's not Humphrey Bogart. And part of it was because every performance he had was so marked by an arrogance that appealed at the time. And I don't just mean the characters were arrogant. I mean the performer was arrogant. Not tough guy. Bogart was a tough guy, but you always saw the wounding, right? And the vulnerability and the sensitivity. Cagney had an arrogance, and even in his even in his dancing, it was arrogant. I mean, his tap dancing, not light on its feet at all.
Oh, interesting.
But it's also, you know, the show is so jingoistic, and it's about a man who made shows that were jingoistic and so completely untrue, you know. But it was something that was needed during World War II. So it's thought of as this essential movie, and I would say that it is because of its importance. And also, hey, directed by Michael Curtiz the same year he makes Casablanca, shot by the great James Wong Howe. The cinematography is phenomenal, and even musical numbers that I did not enjoy while watching them, they've stayed with me because, you know, James Cagney's style of speak singing, which was not a choice made out of historic authenticity, although it just happy coincidence turns out to be how Cohen himself used to sing.
Oh, is that right?
But it's both so bizarre and ludicrous while at the same time kind of becoming infectious.
Yeah, right? I'm a Yankee Doodle dandy.
Yankee Doodle, do or die.
Right? And like, are you singing that? Or
yeah, just, he's so angry. A real live nephew of his Uncle Sam. Born on the 4th of July. You know, he'll like do one line that he sings and that's it.
I know. So funny. So true. I hadn't thought of that. And that is very arrogant. Like, I don't have to sing this. I'll just talk it through.
So it's a time capsule piece, but again, not a film that I can enjoy in the here and now as a great film now the way I could with Music Man. And then the one, the creme de la creme, the piece de resistance, the one I could not wait for, the unbearable, ungodly awful On the Town.
Yeah.
This thing is a dog, and it makes so many lists of like the musicals you have to see and the top films of the 1940s. I barely think they gave a fuck about it while they made it.
Well, it's infectious. I mean, clearly there's a lightness that, yeah, by not giving a fuck, they make it light, infectious, song and dance numbers. I mean, the opening New York, New York, Two Sailors on Shore Leave.
Three.
You got a lot.
Three on Shore Leave.
Yeah, and it's
a montage, an early montage, which I think was probably effective, and I got to give them credit for that. But look, most of the numbers, it's, hey, let's put up a paper mache dinosaur. That'll be their backdrop. They'll stand in front of it. They'll look straight at the camera, and they'll sing and dance.
Yeah. Yeah. There's not much else to it. And even the who gets what girl plotline is so odd. I think about it now and I'm going, yeah, how did that plot work out? It's really not the mainstay of that show.
I have so many other movies that I've seen that I thought we could speak about. I don't even know which direction to go in after that. But why don't I mention wrap up with this? Sarah Silverman, such as yourself, a very gifted comic who is also a very gifted dramatic actor, as it turns out, right? She's she's revealed that in this movie, I Smile Back. Though anyone who had seen her in Sarah Pauley's really underappreciated Take This Waltz would know that Sarah Silverman has real dramatic chops.
Yeah, for sure.
So I Smile Back is a character piece about a woman who suffers from depression and addiction. Though the addiction is the addictions, alcohol and drugs and sex, are a manifestation of the mental illnesses. And it's fascinating because it's she's been hailed. In looking at this film, I knew I wanted to see it because I do like Sarah Silverman and I wanted to see this performance. But I was also aware that only 50% of critics liked this film, and only 40% of audiences liked this film. Now, it didn't surprise me, of course, that the audience number would be lower than the critics. I mean, this is a movie about mental illness and depression and addiction. This is not a huge crowd pleaser, right?
Absolutely not.
But what's interesting, and indeed, look, if it had been a great film where 80% of the critics had loved it, it still might only be 40% of the audience loved it, because it's going to be a difficult watch. In fact, though, the big problem with the film is it's not a difficult watch too often. And I've seen the screenplay criticized, but I got to tell you, the screenplay, which was co-written by the novelist upon whose book this is based. The screenplay is really brilliant. Structurally, it's brilliant, but also it really understands not only psychological patterning, but the patterning that's visited upon us by our parents' emotional patterning and their psychological makeup, and how that gets imprinted upon us in our DNA. And it gets this very well, and it reveals it in wonderfully subtle ways. The screenplay is never hitting our the nail on the head or rubbing our face in it. Sarah Silverman's willing to go to any place this film requires her. And so for me, the weakness is all in the direction. And I realized that the next time I teach a class about directing, I might show this film as how a director can really almost ruin a movie. Yeah, can screw up a good script and a great performance. Because you'd think, right? I mean, there's part of me that wants to believe if the script is good and the lead actor that we're following through every scene is great, how much can really go wrong? Well, it turns out a lot, because in something like this, it's so dependent upon us at times getting to see the world as that character sees the world, so that we can walk in their shoes. And this director, Adam Salke, it's his second film, seems so terrified of going into cliche that he becomes imprisoned by cliche.
Wow.
Clichés are always in the room, right? Because I'm so scared to do that because that might be a cliché, so I stay away from it altogether. Well, it's become a cliché maybe because it works. So the idea is to breathe new life into it, not to avoid it altogether, or you're reacting against something. And, it was really disappointing. And two thoughts about it that I had. One, maybe I'll do this in my own movie, but wouldn't it be interesting to do a first act of a film where you're tied with the point of view of someone who is suffering from a mental illness, and it plays like a horror film?
Right.
Because Sarah Silverman's performance seems very angry, but the character herself even says at one point to her husband when he asks, "Why are you so angry?" And she says, "I'm not angry. Don't you get it? I'm afraid." And I thought that was such a brilliant insight into all this behavior, that it's based on fear. And why fear? Because of loving things too much, of feeling things too intensely. Well, now, how does someone like that walk through the world? The world must be like a horror film constantly.
Yeah.
And can you imagine then making it be that way? And then suddenly you shift your approach, maybe after Act One, to show how living with this person is for the rest of the family, and suddenly your approach becomes very objective and calm.
Yeah.
And so you get to see the this and that of it. And maybe, you know, and I'm not saying I'm coming up with this because, you know, I'm brilliant. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. I just so happen to be a brilliant, brilliant filmmaker. But I'm no spring chicken. And I've been at this a long, long time. And the director of I Smile Back is making his second movie. And it makes me long for, you know, the heyday of studio films of the 1970s, I think, where these films were character-driven and where the people directing them were veteran directors. And those kind of filmmakers don't get hired to do movies like this anymore, because instead of being studio films that might cost a couple million, they have to be very low-budget films, which means it's young or inexperienced filmmakers making them.
Right. Yeah, because nobody wants... You think you have to capture the energy of youth, but you also get the inexperience of youth.
And you're not going to pay for experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, dear God, if Sidney Lumet were still making movies right now, I mean, it's like the only movies he would be able to make are either he'd have to work for less than minimum wage, or he'd have to make a superhero movie.
Yeah, totally.
because
how sad is that?
All those great directors, the movies they made, don't get made anymore. So that's what I was thinking about with that. So that's a really happy place to leave you at the end of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Hey, you know, I wanted to mention, before we mention how everyone can find the show and write us and everything, I'd alluded to the fact that we're on Instagram.
Yes.
And that's at Dean and Phil. Spell out the "and." We post one funny photo a week with really cute hashtags.
Oh, love that.
But I posted onto Instagram a photo of myself, of myself in a Chill Pack Hollywood Hour t-shirt today, and got a question from one of our loyal listeners about whether or not t-shirts like that are for sale.
In
fact,
what?
In fact, his comment was, "Can I buy that shirt?" And I found that creepy because it's my shirt and I've been wearing it and clearly been wearing it for a long time. So no, you can't wear that shirt unless, wait, how much are you willing to pay? But t-shirts much like this, only clean and fresh and, you know, as soft as a newborn baby lamb. I don't know. But it can be yours. So just, write us. Chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. That's CHILLPAK Hollywood@yahoo.com. If you want a Chill Pack Hollywood Hour t-shirt, and we'll get your sizing and we'll figure out how you can PayPal us and where we can send it and all that good stuff. Of course,
absolutely.
Write us to Chillpack Hollywood at yahoo.com anytime you like about whatever you would like us to talk about. We love to talk about what you want us to talk about, provided we find it interesting and have something to contribute. That's one of the things we mean when we say it's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
It's true. What else? You can follow us on Twitter. We're at Dean and Phil, just like the Instagram. Spell out the word "and."
Like us on Facebook.
Yep. Facebook.com/Chill Pack Hollywood.
Please like
and,
us.
Yes, please like us.
Well, and you can find every episode that we've ever done at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
So easy.
What could be easier?
I don't know. How do we make this show easier for people?
All right. Thanks to Blog Talk Radio for hosting us, and, of course, for Empire State Gas for sponsoring us. Until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Belated spoiler alert.